In association with Newsarama, welcome to Word Balloon, the pop culture conversation show. This is John Suntress. The popcorn movie season is underway, not only in terms of film releases, but also production as well. The Batman sequel is underway. Filming is already going on this summer in Chicago. In L.A., the Wachowskis are preparing Speed Racer and have one of their key go-to guys working on the film, and that, of course, is comic book artist Jeff Darrow. Jeff's not going to be around much during convention season due to the filming of Speed Racer, but wanted to present this conversation that I had with Jeff back in 2004, in August of 2004. Jeff and I talk about his work on The Matrix. We also get into his comic book work on things like Shaolin Cowboy, his creation of the character Doc Frankenstein, which is also being published by the Wachowskis' imprint, Burly Man Comics. You'll hear about his collaborations with Frank Miller on things like Big Guy and Rusty the Robot, and of course, Hard Boiled. Jeff's long association with Jean Girard, otherwise known as Mobius, and a mutual appreciation of Jeff's and mine for the Great American Western. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you liked them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% and more. That's right, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. For all the details, go to MailOrderComics.com. I have to thank my good friend Doug Klauba for providing the introduction between Jeff Darrow and myself at the 2004 Wizard World Convention. Jeff was at the table next to Doug's, and we struck up a conversation, and by the end of the weekend, I felt comfortable enough to ask him if he wouldn't mind talking about The Matrix and a lot of his comic book career, and he consented and provided us with this great conversation from 2004. Here's Jeff Darrow on Word Balloon.
Yeah, because I'd worked on the Matrix movies with them, and they'd hear me complaining about comic books and publishers and things. And I'd shown them. I'd started Shaolin Cowboy a long time ago, and it got interrupted because I went off and worked on that first Matrix movie. And then at the end of it, I was working on it, I got tired of it. I thought, well, I don't know if I'll finish this Shaolin Cowboy thing. And I came up with this thing called Doc Frankenstein. So I always liked Doc Savage, and I thought, oh, yeah, I'd sort of like to do a thing like Doc Savage. And that became Doc Frankenstein. And then it changed. It became this a little more political, and it sort of turned into a cross between Citizen Kane and Doc Savage. A little bit of, you know, the Vatican and the American government not too pleased because he has his own sort of city-state within the United States, which sort of comes from, you know, the whole Vatican being a city-state within Italy. And I thought the idea of having that in the U.S., it would make the American government very uneasy. It was ceded to them by the American government for things that the hero had done to save America, but they still were like, you know, just wait for their chance to take it back. And so anyway, but then I decided I didn't want to do it. And then I started working on Shaolin Cowboy again, and then the other two movies came up, the two Matrix sequels. Mm-hmm. And I went off to do those. I'd talk about this Doc Frankenstein thing to Steve Scroes, who was the storyboard artist. He storyboarded, I would imagine, 80% of those, all three movies. He had an incredible amount of work. And he liked it, and he said, you know, would you mind, could I do it? I said, sure, because I, at that point I wasn't going to do it. And I'd kind of drawn him out, and we talked about it, and I told him my ideas, and then he started working on it. And about this point, at the end of the two Matrix movies, and they were about finished, the Wachowskis wanted to know if they could print them. They wanted to just sort of get into comics, sort of, because they had started out in comics. They had worked for Marvel on doing a comic called The Ecto Kid, and that's where they had met Steve. Steve Scroes drew those. To this day, I'm not so sure Marvel even realizes the guys that did Ecto Kid were the guys that did The Matrix. I think I got a feeling they're just kind of going, huh, this is a funny, we had a couple guys here called Wachowski, and they're just like those guys that did those movies. Because they would think they would reprint them, just maybe I'm being very naive, and the fact is they've thought of it, but maybe there's something to do with Barker, where he owns the rights where they can't do
Okay.
I don't know.
We're going to bounce back and forth, and the only reason why I want to start with Shaolin Cowboy is it's the new product, and it's I want to give you an opportunity to inform people who haven't had a chance to pick up the book yet. I've read all three issues. I love it. I'm not quite sure what's going on, but I do still love it. I mean, loads of hardcore graphic violence, so there's plenty to love there. Three is the most recent issue, am I correct?
Yeah, well, yeah, I've got six of them done.
Because you did, as you said, you started this a few years ago.
Yeah, and this is the oddest thing in comics. Generally, it's me. I'm always late. And, you know, Frank, I work with Frank Miller on Hardboiled.
Yep.
And then when I worked on The Big Guy, I was pretty slow. But in this case, I have enough. But the guy that's late here is my colorist. And, you know, it's an odd thing because I don't think that's new in comics. Generally, you don't wait on the colorist. But he's done a really beautiful job, but it's just hard to get the stuff out of him. So, you know, the next one, he's almost done with it, and it'll come out probably the middle or towards the end of September. And the fifth and sixth one, I don't know, because he hasn't started them. So,
will this be a finite series, or is this...
No, it keeps going.
Okay.
It's sort of a weird kind of road trip thing.
There clearly is a history of this guy that's being hinted at. And also, I loved in the third issue the various covers of previous volumes. Well, you're on, like, volume 51 right now of...
Yes. And the sad thing about that, is that there will probably be people that think that there are. I have run that, because in Europe, I've done this before, and I did a book over there, and that's what those drawings are actually from.
Okay.
That featured this character. Because I used to love Tintin. And on the back of Tintin, they had all these, even in America, all these covers of previous issues. And I thought that was funny if I would just do a bunch of fake ones. But to this day, in Europe, there are still people that think that there's a whole lot, even here, that think that those are all books that were printed, and they haven't been. I mean, I've been in bookstores where people have come in and tried to order them, and they've gotten annoyed because... Well, you know, it says here, you know, these are the other titles. Why can't I get them?
If you were to give someone a description of Shaolin Cowboy.
It's basically a Western, sort of. I mean, I've always liked Westerns, except, I mean, I think everything is a Western. I mean, Star Wars is a Western. I mean,
absolutely.
I was a huge, I still am a fan of it. And I remember when they first announced it, it was in Time Magazine. They were talking about how the next big wave was going to be science fiction. And leading the wave would be this movie called Damnation Alley. And then there was going to be this movie by this guy that had done American Graffiti. And they quoted Lucas in it saying, it's a spaghetti western in space. And that always stuck with me because I love spaghetti westerns.
Absolutely.
And I thought, yeah, if I can, do something kind of like that. So I mean, because westerns, people don't like them. And I talked to Frank Miller and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm doing this comic and I'm going to call it The Shaolin Cowboy. He said, well, I'll give you a piece of advice. Don't put cowboy in the title. Because it'll scare people off. So I took his advice. The guys were like, well, that makes it like, yeah. Because Frank, I remember what he was doing. Sin City, everybody told him, it ain't going to work. You can't do crime comics. Nobody's going to be interested. And I think that sort of pushed him forward. He went, yeah, well, I'm going to make it work. And he did. And so I'm not saying that I've succeeded, but I'm trying. But, I mean, it's only a Western. I mean, there's a lot of... obvious Western elements to it, but it's a fantasy, and there'll be some science fiction elements to it. I just wanted to do something that allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious, I think, and especially your first villain.
That was only supposed to be like a 6-page preface to what is the third issue. And I started drawing it, and I kind of got away from me, and then I kept thinking, well, I have a villain in here. I'd drawn, and there's this big, long spread of 10 pages, which is this all these guys that are waiting for him. And I'd just drawn a crab on the ground just for laughs, and as I was thinking about it, who can I have him fight? And I thought, I got that crab in there. And I don't know, I just thought it would be really funny to have a guy fighting a crab.
A very adept martial arts
he thinks he is.
Yes.
I mean, he has, I mean, because I met a guy, actually he's kind of based on a guy that I used to work with at Hanna-Barbera who studied martial arts. And he was, pretty good at it. And I think he got into trouble with the police because he beat somebody up. And, he was very adept and he would kind of show off. And, I'd watched, I'd read a little bit, and I always thought the whole object of knowing any sort of self-defense was that you wouldn't have to use it
right.
to show off. And this guy, I remember sitting I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and we'd go to this Japanese theater downtown and watch samurai movies, and they were showing martial arts, and they showed a guy breaking these bricks with his hands and stuff. And I said to him, can you do that? And he said, yeah, but I'd rather break heads. And I looked at him, and I said, isn't that kind of against what they teach you? He goes, oh, you're right. And I guess so that kind of is where the crab comes from, somebody that, you know, he kind of went to that temple and didn't take anything away from it.
And
but even they weren't. Well, anyway. If you've read it, you'll see.
Yes.
You've read it, but if anybody else read it.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I don't want to give too much away, and that's why I want to keep it kind of general, because people really, you ought to check this out. It's a very interesting book, and as always, wonderful art. And you know, that's always been a hallmark of everything you do.
It's very nice of you to say. I've always had a hard time with my drawing.
Really?
I mean, I look at it, I've looked at drawings of 10 years ago, and I guess that wasn't so bad after all. Sometimes I'd be surprised. Why, gee, I'm surprised I actually was able to do that. Because, I went to art school here in Chicago, and believe me, I wasn't anywhere near the top of the class. I was kind of the joke.
Were there anybody else in your class?
Yeah, there was another comic book artist called Gary Gianni.
Absolutely.
And he's a very well-known children's book illustrator by the name of Scott Gustafson. And another gentleman named Rick Burnell, who's also a children's books illustrator. We were all very close.
That's cool.
And
Gary,
still are, yeah.
Gary, for people who don't know, currently doing Prince Valiant, and of course had great runs on The Shadow in the 90s for Dark Horse.
Right, and he's illustrated three incredible books of the works of Robert E. Howard. He did Bram McMorn, King Cole, he did Solomon Kane.
Okay.
King Cole's actually in the Bram McMorn book, and he did one of the Conan. He did the only Conan novel that Howard wrote.
Well, let's keep bouncing back and forth. And first of all, prior to Hard Boiled, is there comic book work out there that we should be aware of?
Well, one. I did one in Europe, and I worked with an artist named Jean Giraud, who's known as Mobius.
Yes, of course.
And we're going to do a comic book together, but instead it turned into a portfolio called The City of Fire. And there were 10 very complicated drawings that I drew. And then he inked and colored them. That kind of put me on the map in Europe.
That guy's amazing. I mean, I'm a huge fan. Of course, his Silver Surfer was fantastic for American fans to grab onto. But, yeah, certainly, you know, heavy metal and you know, things like that.
He's more famous over in Europe doing a Western called Lieutenant Blueberry, which they made into a movie.
Yeah, it was
a horrible, horrible movie.
Yeah, with Richard Gere and...
it's with, what's his name? Well, a French guy, actually.
Depardieu?
No, that day they wish. It was actually a guy you probably never, Vincent Cassel.
Okay.
And Juliette Lewis is in it.
Oh, okay.
And Michael Madsen. If you can believe it, the end of it turns into The Matrix. It's just so weird. And actually, you know, Giraud actually kind of liked it because it was more like Mobius than it was like his other artistic identity, Giraud, because it just turned into this acid trip at the end. And if you can believe, it's called Renegade, and it's out on DVD. You can see it, but it's really rough to watch. Wow.
and Giraud did an alternate cover for you for Shaolin
3. We've remained friends, and, you know, I asked him, and... You know, he did. I don't think he's even seen the comic book. probably would regret having done it if he actually saw it.
How did you hook up with Frank Miller then for Hard Boiled?
Well, I had actually met him through Mobius, because Mobius was living in L.A. and I was actually living in France at the time. But I would come back during the summer to Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and I was in Los Angeles, and I went to. Mobius's house. He's rented a house there, and he said, "Oh, you know, Frank Miller's coming over." And you know, I was like, "Wow," because you know, it's Frank Miller, and you know, I think, because I was a big fan, and I went over to Mobius's house, and Frank came, and I don't think Mobius was even there, you know. and so we got to talking, and you know, this and that, and some time up. And I'd call him from France every once in a while, because Dark Knight had come out by then, and I called him up to tell him how much I liked it. And I don't think he ever really knew what it was I did, except it was with this guy that was over at Mobius's house. And one day he said to me, because I'd sent him this City of Fire thing and this book that I'd done, and he said, "You didn't tell me that you did this and this." He said, "I didn't realize that was you." And I said, "Yeah." And I moved back to Los Angeles about a year or two after that, and we became close friends, and we were walking in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles, and he said, "Do you ever do, you know, anybody else's material? So if somebody wrote something for you?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "If I wrote something, would you draw?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "What would you like to do?" I said, "Something with a lot of action." And that became Hard Boiled.
And Hard Boiled was before Sin City.
Yeah. I started it before Sin City, but I was working on that, and he was working finishing up Electra Lives.
Okay.
And I think Sin City, I can't remember if it came out before or at the same time. But then he started that. And
did some of the ideas of Hard Boiled, like, kind of inspire what led to Sin City?
I don't think so.
No?
Because they're two different things. I mean, I think I really frustrated Frank because I wasn't sure. I'd never worked with a writer, and I always kind of thought that when you were given a script, you kind of did what you wanted. And I would go off on these tangents, and because he'd given me that, I don't know if you've ever seen a comic, but the first issue, that was 10 pages of script.
Okay.
And I turned it into 30-something. And he, I remember doing them, and like, the first page it said, he's in an alley and he's shot, mm-hmm. and there's two dead guys laying at his feet, and then a car comes roaring down, and that's what he wrote. And then I turned it into this thing where he's standing there, like, all these dead guys everywhere, mm-hmm. big giant car. He's like, "Holy smokes!" He goes, "What the heck?" And then I started drawing. I don't know if you've ever seen any of it, but things.
Yeah.
That big fat guy in the tub with all that machine with the babies in it and stuff. And he goes, "What the hell is this?" And I said, "I don't know. It's like it's a nutritional machine. It keeps him alive." And, he's okay. And it just kind of, and he wasn't supposed to, in the comic, the main character was called Nixon, but
right.
It's human. But I draw him doing all this. He says, "Yeah, there's no one's going to believe this. That he could survive, we're going to have to make him a cyborg." And then he ends up being a robot.
Right.
Because I drew all that stuff, the license plates sticking out of his kneecaps, and he's all broken up, and there's no way a human could survive that. I said, "It's a comic book, who cares?"
Well, that's a great thing about your work, Jeff, as you do. You break the rules all the time. And that's the beauty of comic books is, I mean,
well,
that's...
I'm always amazed by people that will say, like you said to me, "How can that mule talk?" And I said, "I don't know." And, maybe it's, he's like, "Exact, well, I won't tell you what, but there's a reason why he talks." But it bothers him. And I'll say to him, "Well, you read Superman?" And, "Oh, yeah, that doesn't bother you?" "What do you mean? Well, this guy that can fly, how does he, if you think about it, I think a talking mule is probably a little bit easier to accept, but no, that bugs him." I find that really funny. Because I've even been told by, I remember Archie Goodwin, I'd shown him this thing that I'd done, and, he said it was a lot of cosmic gobbledygook. And I said, to him, if you substituted what was going on there, just instead of it being, I don't know what it was some sort of radioactive cabbage or something. I said, "If you substituted the cosmic cube, would it be okay?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "So what's the difference?" But, it's that whole, it's funny that guys that in comics, you get these crazy superhero characters, it doesn't bother them, but as soon as you draw like a human being doing something a little odd, that just kind of, if that makes any sense, they can't get it.
Well, Frank must not have been that mad at you for Hard Boiled, because you guys went on to do Big Eye and Rusty the Robot.
Yeah, he wasn't mad. I think it was just difficult, because he'd tell me, he said, "Jeff, I'd get those pages from you, and I'd just kind of stalk around the apartment for 2 days. What am I going to do with this?"
Was the process then his script, your art, and then his dialogue? Is that how?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he would say he'd have to end up having to rewrite stuff. And I think it kind of happened to him, too, with Bill Sienkiewicz. When Bill was doing Electra Assassin, mm-hmm. he would have a lot of pretty wild visuals in there. And it kind of threw him, too, because I think he wrote more complete scripts for Bill, because after a while, he just gave up. I would get just paragraphs. I mean, he would never see anything. Like, the big guy was only 3 paragraphs, and I went off and just drew it, and he saw it when it was done. And the same with, I would, hide stuff from him. I'm fairly insecure. And I think if I show this to anybody, they're going to say, "What the hell is this? Stop." And I figure if I draw enough of it, it'll be just too late. And I was like, well, I'll have to, because that's the same sort of work Abbott on the Matrix movies. They never saw, you know, until I was done.
They had no idea what the Sentinels were going to look like until you were done.
No. I mean, they would know. They talked to me about it. They said, okay. They'd tell me what they wanted. But I'd go off and, you know, I told them, I said, I'm a little odd, and you can't look at my drawings until they're done. And they would not. They would not go into my room, and they would not let anybody else. Even the producer, Joel Silver, they go, you can't look at what he's doing unless he says you can. And that's a very, Joel Silver is just this, like, human hurricane. What do you mean you can't? What do you mean I can't look at it? Yeah, that's just the way it works. And it used to bug him. And then after a while, they all got used to it, and they would just, you know, let me go. And it was kind of risky because, you know, some of these drawings that I would do for The Matrix would last. It'd take me a week or 2 weeks to do. And if it was... If I was off, then that's 2 weeks down the drain. But it, luckily enough, never happened. I always sort of did what they wanted, and that was something Silver was just, I think, a little jealous of, because somehow we were wired together. We had the same sort of thinking about stuff.
You and the Wachowskis?
Yeah.
How early on in the process were you brought in to start conceptualizing a lot of their ideas?
Well, when they wanted to do The Matrix, the studio didn't understand it at all. And they had to, they said, we want to give us some money to bring some guys in here, and we'll draw it, and you'll see what we want to do. Because they couldn't figure, because they wanted to do a manga, anime movie, superhero movie, and with Kung Fu. And at that point, Kung Fu literally was Steven Seagal.
Sure.
And the studios, you know, because they at one point had tried to bring Jet Li in to get him into The Matrix at the very beginning. And nobody, they said, oh, this guy's horrible, you know. The only guy that can really do convincing kung fu martial arts is Steven Seagal. And he was the guy, they were the guys that introduced Hollywood to Jet Li and all those, and that's how Jet Li got his start. Because they eventually, you know, they finally, you know, even Silver finally hired him. So they wanted it to look different, and they were big fans of Hard Boiled, and they had Warner's track me down. I was living in the countryside in France. They called up my publisher at the time, his Dark Horse.
Right.
And they said, you know, we're looking for this guy, Jeff Darrow. He wanted to work on a movie. And they said, who are you? And they said, well, you know, you don't work with this guy because he's difficult. I found out this later. I go, that's nice.
Wow.
That's nice. But they didn't care. And they said, well, we want him. And the studio said, no, we don't want him. And Joel Silver didn't. And finally, they said, you know, if that's what you want, well, I'll get you this guy. So they tracked me down, and being the goofball that I am, they said, do you want to work on this movie? And I said, well, I'd like to read the script, because I don't know if I can do it. And if I read it, I think I can do it. Because it's a big mistake to try, maybe at the beginning, but it, just to do something to do it. If you can't do it right, it's really not worth doing it. And movies... people are dying to get into movies, and it's, you know, if you go in there and you do a lousy job, then you get one shot at it, and you're out. I didn't want to just do it for the sake of doing it, and I'd done a little movie work at that point. And it's not always the funnest thing in the world, because you're not treated very well.
Would we know those other films before The Matrix?
No, they never. None of them ever got made.
Okay.
One was a thing with Ridley Scott that never got made. So anyway, they sent me the script, and I thought it was brilliant, and I said, yeah. They flew me out to meet with them, and this was, and you know, they gave me some work to do, and the first thing I ever drew for them was this, you know, those power plants, those big, with the people that are like light bulbs plugged into those towers. That was the first drawing I did.
Wow.
And they had described to me, well, they're kind of like petals, you know, on a flower. They kind of go around the stalk, and I said, okay. I misunderstood them, and I drew these giant things. And I remember I faxed it to them, and they would laugh about it because it took the fax machine, I don't know, so long for it to finally, it was like tick, 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 because it was so dense.
Sure.
And I didn't hear from them for 3 days. I thought, well, that's it. I did a lousy job. And they finally called me up, and they said, you know, we were shocked when we saw it because that actually isn't the way we saw it, but it's worse than we would have imagined it to be. It's a lot more frightening. And they
sure.
said that I was the guy for them. And that was, so then I worked for 3 months on it, and that's all the money they had. And then about 3 months out of it, they called me up and they said, look, would you be willing to come out here? They've given us some more money. And I went out and I worked another 3 months. so that they could put this whole book together to go and show it to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers finally saw what it was they wanted to do, because we had done drawings of what bullet time, what became bullet time was. But there was one thing I drew that they didn't show them because they knew they'd freak out if they saw it. And that was what became known as the fetus field, which was those machines that were going through plucking those babies off the stalks, because they thought they would freak.
Sure.
So that was one thing they didn't show.
And one of the best images of the film.
Yeah, yeah. Afterwards they got the money. Because they were, through the whole thing, they were trying to get stars to be in it. Because the only way they get made is if they could get a star. That's how things work. And they have a list.
Sure.
You get this list, and it's like the first 15 guys are the guys, if you get it, you can get the movie greenlit. And then there's like the second tier. And, I mean, they met with Leonardo DiCaprio.
That's interesting.
And it was right after, it was right before Titanic came out. And I think, like, I understand it was his dad had wanted him to come in because his dad liked my comic books. Dad's name is George DiCaprio.
Oh, wow.
And he's a big comic book fan. And he said, you got to go in, because they got this guy, Jeff Darrow, working on it. And so he went in and he talked to him, and he really liked the script. And he said, I'd love to do it, except, he said, I just did this movie called Titanic. And it was a special effects movie, and it was so hard. He said, I don't think I could do another one right now. And then the guy that really wanted to do it then, because there were some other guys I'm not going to mention that,
okay,
you know, that I thought were really cool and turned out to be not so cool because they didn't understand it at all. And one of the guys that came in and wanted to do it was David Duchovny, and he was almost going to do it. And then they met Keanu, and Keanu understood it completely. And they crunched numbers, and they realized that a Keanu Reeves movie always at least breaks even.
Wow.
Because in Japan and a few other places, his movies always average a certain amount of money. So they knew if they had Keanu Reeves in this movie, they would, and they kept it at a certain budget,
mm-hmm,
the movie would at least break even. And Warner's was really impressed, and Keanu wanted to do it, and that's when they got the green light.
They got a great start, and they got a full commitment because, I mean, there's a guy that's, you know, been involved in every incarnation of the Matrix, whether it's the games or the...
Oh, no, and he worked. That guy works so hard. He has a work ethic that's amazing because he would come in. You know, I always talk about these guys. Oh, I trained for 3 weeks before I started. You know, he trained for 6 to 8 months. And I'm not talking about going in. I mean, really, he'd be in there Saturdays and Sundays doing this stuff, going over and over and over. That guy, you know, I mean, he's like De Niro in a sense. I mean, because he just puts so much into it. And he's so hard on himself. And he's a really, you know, whether you like what he does or not, I mean, in terms of as a person, as an artist or an actor, he works really hard. Whether he pulls it off every time, I don't know. But he sure does try.
Do you know if there's any future plans? I know the computer game is alive and well, and obviously Burly Man keeps releasing the anthologies of stories.
They've always said when they... Because, I mean, I don't know what people think of them, but they really were never in it for the money. And, I mean, because they could, you know, make another one, or they could,
sure,
do this. Or, I mean, you know, they were offered Spider-Man right after the first one, and they could have went off and done it. And they didn't. And, you know, they've been offered a lot of stuff, and they just, you know, didn't want to. And they've always said, you know, if we run out of all money, so we run out of our money, you know.
We'll
go back and do another one, but
wow.
I mean, it ends. I mean,
sure.
I mean, they could, but I would be really surprised if they did. I mean, we at one point talked about doing a comic book sequel, and they would write it, and we would draw it. But I don't know. You know, I wouldn't say they won't, but you know, right now they're working on V for Vendetta, which is kind of, considering the timing, is just kind of rough.
That's a really challenging project, and
well,
and yeah, I mean,
considering what's going on in London, I mean, it's just really bad timing. And although it's not the same thing, it's still, you got a hero who's a terrorist, and
absolutely.
I think it's scheduled for February now.
Okay,
but I don't know. You know.
Yeah. All right. Did you do any work for the film?
No. I was gonna, and then I don't know if you're gonna hear any Hollywood talk, but it's,
oh, absolutely.
They have in a movie, it's a European production, and when it's a European production, in order to get the tax break, you can have just so many non-Europeans working on it. Now, despite the fact that I'm living in France at the time and I'm a resident, I still wasn't committed European. And they said, you know, Jeff, you're bad spend. I said, well, you know, I've known that all my life, but what do you exactly mean? And they said, well, they can only have so much bad spend on a film, and the bigger the position you have, the more of your bad spend allotment you use. And the director, whose name is James McTeague, is from Australia. And you would kind of think that he would be considered, even he's not considered part of, you know, the European community, although, you know, Australia is a commonwealth, the Australian.
Sure.
So between him, the brothers, I mean, it really doesn't, and that's not something that they would need me for, because, I mean, it's not a fantasy film, and there's nothing really imaginary in it.
That's true, and they've got the graphic novel to sort of be their conceptual Bible.
Yeah, and there's...
Dave Lloyd's pretty good.
Yeah, he's good. Yeah. And he's really happy with it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. I mean, you know, everyone knows about the flap between Joel and
Alan.
Yeah,
well, there was, you know, I think, you know, I really respect Alan, and I think it's just been some cross wires, because I think Joel was misquoted, believe me. I know Mr. Silver's capable of stepping on people's toes really easily, but in this case, I know he has nothing but a lot of respect for Alan Moore, and it wasn't, I think things were taken out of context. And,
okay.
And believe me, I'm not trying to, you know, I couldn't give a rat's ass. Alan likes Joel Silver or not. I mean, but in this case, I think it's just a big misunderstanding.
No, that's cool. No, I appreciate your perspective on it. Before we leave The Matrix, I wanted to ask about the Animatrix.
I think it's, you know, I know in Japan it's considered a huge, huge landmark, because it really brought into America, brought to the forefront a lot of animators and stuff that had been, and it's really loved over there.
What's
I was fortunate enough. I was just so well treated on those movies. I did the press tours for all three movies, and I got to go to Japan each time the movie came out. So I was there for these incredible premieres that just, you know, it's a lifestyle stuff that I would never have been exposed to if I hadn't done these movies. And even, I mean, somebody in my position never gets to go. I mean, they never send a guy that drew pictures on a movie. I'm in Tokyo, and I'm standing with Keanu Reeves, and there's 40,000 people screaming, and, you know, and you have to talk. It's just, it was surreal. And, you know, and they just love those, I mean, those movies over there. And they love Keanu, and they're just huge over there.
They're great movies. And no, and I really think the Animatrix did a lot to get non-anime fans interested in anime.
They had this whole idea when they did the sequels to do this multimedia thing where they'd have a cartoon, they'd have a video game. But it was all stuff that they were heavily invested in. The brothers themselves, they did a really, really good job. I mean, if you look at it, there wasn't a lot of merchandising on those movies.
Well,
there weren't 60 gazillion action figures. There weren't a lot of T-shirts. There weren't, you know, cola tie-ins, and there was no sort of Star Wars or Spider-Man blitz.
Well, there kind of was,
but that was because they didn't want to do it. What?
There kind of was for the last two, though, wasn't there? I mean, it seemed
The most of it was just like hype. I mean, there was a lot of, you know,
McDonald's and, you know, the fast food tie-ins and things like that.
There weren't any fast food tie-ins.
No.
No.
Okay,
no.
Or soft drinks. I mean, I
Nope. No. They had a thing with Heineken.
Well, that's
and that was it.
That's not typical.
No. But I mean, that was, you know, a lot of it was when you make a movie, it was so expensive, you have to get money. And a lot of people think, you know, well, a movie makes, you know, gosh, it made $100 million. Well, you know, if you spend $100 million on a movie, you have to make 200 to break even, and that's a lot of money.
How many times do you hear about the marketing budget, you know, obviously more than overshadowing what the actual production budget was.
So, you know, but I mean, there weren't a lot of, you didn't see like a line of clothes, you didn't see, there were some things, but I mean, not compare, I mean, you know, like
Star Wars,
Star Wars or Spider-Man or I don't know what other ones. There's a lot of them. They just, you know, you can buy toilet paper with them.
Well, luckily it was probably because they kept him R-rated movies too. And
no, it was them. They didn't want him to do it. They didn't want their fans to think that they were
selling out
and treating them like shit. They wanted whatever they did with the Matrix. They wanted it to be quality, and the Animatrix was the game. It was all real high quality. They filmed. They were filming on the sets. They were.
Yeah.
There's a separate movie in that game, which
yes.
Nobody had ever done. Now everybody's doing it, but they were the first ones to do that.
No, definitely. No, and I I'll tell you, as a boxing fan, I was glad to see Roy Jones get a little bit more screen time in the game.
Oh yeah. He came in, and they're big fans of him, so they wanted him in the movie. And I remember him coming into the studio, and they would always kind of laugh because at one point, well, John Milius had come into the studio, and they brought him in to meet me because they knew I was a big fan, and I had all these Western old pulp magazines and stuff, and he came in and he goes, "My God, where did you get the?" And we started talking about Westerns, and they're like doing the, you know, cut your neck thing, because they had to get him out of there. And he's talking to me about, you know, all these old Western movies, and then when Roy Jones came in, and you know, they introduced me to him, and we started, you know. And I said, "So you like?" I said, "You like the movies?" He goes, "You like?" He goes, "Yeah, but I prefer Westerns." And they rolled their eyes up. I'm like, see what I tell you.
let's stick with Westerns for a second, Jeff, and I'll ask you who are your favorite Hollywood filmmakers that handled Westerns? I mean, obviously Ford,
of course, Leone.
Sure.
And there was a guy called Bud Boddicker who did these movies with Randolph Scott that were just, you know, they're very famous in Europe. They're very famous in France, which is where I saw them. And they're very small budget pictures that were just brilliant. I mean, they're really good. They're almost impossible to find on DVD or anything. But they're really, really beautiful little movies.
Is the Encore Western Channel? It seems like they
run them. They'll run them every once in a while. They did one that's based on an Elmore Leonard story called The Tall T. It's fantastic.
Oh, that's cool.
And you know, I like a little Peckinpah.
Absolutely.
But, you know, Raoul Walsh has done some.
Oh, no question. Great Wayne films with Raoul Walsh, absolutely.
And the really old, if you watch any of the really old Gunsmoke, the half-hour episodes were brilliantly written, and some of them adapted by Peckinpah.
That guy, John Meston, the guy who wrote
Gunsmoke. Oh, just amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Gunsmoke radio show.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you know, they did I'll go back and forth between, I prefer the radio show to the TV show.
Me too.
But, I mean, I love that. You've seen have you ever seen Anthony Quinn, where William Conrad plays, finally gets to sort of play Matt Dillon. They took one of the Gunsmoke scripts and they produced it as a movie.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
It's called The Ride Back. You can find it on DVD.
I will look for that.
And it's William Conrad playing this marshal, and it's him sort of getting to be, although he's not the same, you know, superhuman guy that he is in the TV show.
Well, you know, and Arnest did a great job on the TV show,
yeah.
and the TV show is wonderful. There's a reason why it lasted for 20 years, obviously. But, there's that chemistry between William Conrad and Parley Bear, and Conrad was just what a commanding voice. It's a shame. It came at the end of radio, and it's such a great example of good audio drama. It's just such a well-produced show.
Well, there's a few of them. Like, there's one called Frontier Gentleman.
Yeah, with
John Diner. Was
yes.
Brilliant. You know, same guys. And they all worked on another called Fort Laramie.
Yes.
With Raymond Burr.
Yes.
And those were great. I mean, they're just very, you know.
Well, that was the time of the 50s Westerns, and that was the resurgence of the more cerebral Westerns, I think. Well, let's return to some of your work and talk for a second about Big Guy and Rusty the Robot. Clearly influenced by Astro Boy and the Toho films, and I thought just a neat collaboration, and certainly a 180 from what you guys did on Hard Boiled in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd wanted to do a superhero, and I always liked robots and stuff, and, well, the Metal Men and
sure.
Gort from The Day They Stood Still, and Iron Man, and I wanted to do something like that, and Frank said, "Well, we can do it, you know, and we'll do this thing." And we came up, and he originally was just the big guy, and then he was going to be fighting this thing in Japan, and I thought it'd be funny if he had this little the Japanese national hero, their Superman is Astro Boy.
Absolutely.
And I thought it'd be funny if he shows up and he has to fight Astro Boy, because Astro Boy, the Japanese don't want him there. we take care of we fight our own fights, and sort of an American imperialism. We're like, we got to stop this thing. We got to nip it in the bud, because if it gets out of Japan, it's gonna that whole thing. But I mean, it changed. But that was my take on it, and I drew it, and Frank liked him so much, the drawing I did of him. He said, "Well, why can we make him his sidekick?" I said, sure. So there was no longer going to be a big fight between those two. It was just going to be, he said, have him, he shows up, and he just gets flattened. And the whole idea of it is, and we never did it, was, if we ever did any more, was he was going to get destroyed every story. And the big guy doesn't really like him. He kind of tolerates him. And the Japanese government were so indebted, they have, much about Japan, but they always had this, they're so in debt that they would just keep rebuilding it. And it's not necessary, but, we rebuilt him, and like I said, everyone, he would get destroyed. But Frank really liked writing that character.
Are there any DVD plans for the series? Is it available?
No, I don't. That's a really odd. It did well. Fox Kids program is run by a guy, and he owns every piece of the show, of the shows, except that one when it was on. And he said, give me a piece of it, or I'll bury it. And they said, well, we're not going to give it up. And he did bury it.
Wow.
And it's so, because it moved around the schedule. When it was on, it did well. And so finally, they pulled it off, the schedule. I mean, they had big plans for that thing. They had Bandai was doing toys, and they had a Wendy's tie-in. And
okay.
They did the toys. And it's real funny, because you go to Wendy's, you see these displays for this character that nobody knew what the heck it was, because it was only on for 4 weeks before they yanked it.
Wow.
And the same thing, the toys, Bandai just pulled them. They did some, and they pulled them. They said, nobody knows what this thing is. There's no tie-in. You promised us a tie-in, and we don't have it. And so they yanked it, and then they had to fill in the summer so that they either had to run them, or they would lose their rights to them. So the guy finally programmed them, and they did really well. And but they said, well, we got enough of them. We'll just keep running these over and over and over.
Wow.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I've only seen one episode of it.
Okay.
Because I had very little involvement with it, because they really wanted to change it at the beginning. It was like RoboCop. He worked for some corporation in a city, and I said, that's not what he is. He's an army man. He's a big metal G.I. Joe. He's not like me. He's very right-wing, and he's just, And he's that. And they, we won't like this. But to their credit, the creative people of Fox said, when they took it to them, the studio, Sony took it to them, they said, no, we like this comic book. If it's not the comic book, we don't want it. And so they changed it somewhat, but because they wanted him to be a robot. And I said, he's not a robot. He's a guy in there.
Right.
And I said, he's in there, and he's driving it like a car. He's got a steering wheel, and there's a stick shift. And I said, there's a Coke machine and a candy machine behind him, and there's air conditioning in there because it overheats sometimes. And I was describing all that, and they go, well, that they didn't like that at all. And eventually they did put it in there, but, they changed that quite a bit. But so I didn't have much to do with it, except I did a few monsters for them. I mean, to such an extent that they were showing it in France, and my daughter had it on television on Sunday morning, and there was this cartoon show on this big monster thing. And I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. And I sat down to watch it, and I was watching. And I thought, oh, this is really well done. And the wall breaks open, and in comes the big guy. And I said, holy smokes! I said to my daughter, that's your father's cartoon show. That one and the pilot episode, which they showed at the San Diego convention before it opened, were the only ones I ever saw.
Wow. And I always wonder if DC took...
Oh, they did. Oh, they did. And you know what they said? Because I know some in an editor, they talked about it. He said, well, they're not doing it, so we might as well.
Okay, so that's where Stars and Stripes came from.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's just that sort of, I hate that kind of crap.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, nothing's new. I mean, it wasn't new, but
sure.
Come on. I mean, if you want to do something, then do something like it, but put your own spin on it. I thought that was a pretty, and I think I knew the guy that was writing it, too. But
I know Jeff Johns was the guy who wrote it, but I don't know if he's the one who came up with it.
I just,
No, I understand. No, man, hell, I don't blame you.
I mean, nothing's new. I mean, nothing I do is ever new, but, but you know, you put your own spin on it and try to... I mean, you know, there's a big debate in comics, and I think there's a lot of people that swipe people's artwork. I mean, they just copy it. And, well, everybody does it. I said, well, I don't do it. I do not like it when people copy my drawing. I'm not talking about stylistically, because everybody has their influences, and I certainly have mine. But when somebody sits down with a piece of tracing paper and copies a drawing and puts it and sells it to somebody, I thought, for me, that's piracy. But I've had guys come up to me and say, you know, man, you know, I really like what you do, and, you know, I was swiping one of your drawings, but it was too damn hard, so I just traced it. And I was like, the guy was really proud of himself, and I kind of went, well, thank you.
Yeah, I guess.
What do you say?
Yeah, and you'll hear from my attorney.
No, you can't. You can never win. You can't win a lawsuit like that.
No, I understand. Impossible. No, and, you know, I don't mind lightboxing, and I know that's a current debate going on, too.
I don't. I think
okay. Well, all right.
You mean, what do you mean? What do you say by lightboxing? What do you mean?
Well, I guess that's the gray area. I don't know. You know, yeah.
When you say lightboxing, what are you talking about?
Well, are you starting with a photograph and then, you know, coming up with a drawing from a photograph? You know, that's I guess what I know.
Well, no, I mean, people do that. I mean, generally that stuff comes off pretty stiff. That stuff, I don't think people can do whatever they want. When we say lightboxing, I thought you're admitting saying they take like a Neil Adams drawing and they trace it, and they, you know, they put a mustache on it instead of, and
sure,
they take the ears off the Batman cowl, and that stuff I don't like.
No, and
it's
I agree
lazy
with you. But yeah, I mean, I'm talking about artists like Greg Land and Tim Bradstreet that, you know, start with photorealism, and Tim is a guy that takes his own photographs, obviously, and then draws from those. You know, I mean, he has his own models.
People can do whatever they want. It just, if you're too photo reliable, at least in my opinion, and, you know, like the opinions are worth exactly what they cost. it's boring. And I see there's a lot of comics that do that. I can see, you can tell when they're doing it, and they're just boring because they, when somebody goes to throw a fist or throw a punch or they're jumping through the air or whatever it is, it's not exciting because they can't, you can't do it. You can't get somebody to jump up and take a decent enough photo, so it's always a sort of stilted,
bit of action.
At least in my opinion, but anyway.
No, I respect that. Let's talk about your collaborations with Andrew Vax, another 180 from this other work. You have really collaborated with some really interesting writers and very distinct writers, and certainly Andrew Vax, who transcends crime and comics with the subjects that he writes about. Given all of your other work that is so violent and in a lot of ways fantastic, here's a very real subject that you've drawn in these books, you know, things like Another Chance to Get It Right and Half-Breed. And
well, he had told me that, because I'd heard him on this show called Fresh Air.
Oh, sure, the NPR show.
Yeah, and he was talking about it, and I thought, wow, this guy really knows, sounds like he knows what he's talking about. And I thought he was really interesting, and I wrote down the name of his, you know, book, and I was going to buy it, and I forgot about it. And of all things, I was in this store, and I was walking by the cooking section, and there's this book, and I don't know what, and I turned, and it was his book. Now, what his book was doing, somebody had picked it up and just left it there. And I go, oh, that's that guy that was on the radio. And I, you know, otherwise I probably never would have picked, I never would have found it. But I bought it, and I read it, and I thought it was amazing. And it just rung so true, and it talked about such important stuff. And I remember talking to the people at Dark Horse, and they turned me on to Silence of the Lambs, which I thought was really great. I said, we're going to read something really great. I said, read this Andrew Vax book. I mean, it'd make a great comic book. And so they read it, and they said, yeah, and they got hold of him. And he went out there to see him, and he told me that when they showed him stuff that they're capable of doing, they showed him Hard-Boiled.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that that was what everybody did. And so they kept showing him, when they went to do this series with him, they kept showing him, they go, where's that Hard-Boiled guy? I thought that's the guy I want.
That's cool.
And they were going to do Another Chance, and I'd said I'd do a story in it, and they gave it to me, and I called him up, and he's a very, you know, intimidating man, because
sure,
I mean, he's not just, you know, physically, but just intellectually, because the man's a genius. I mean,
yeah,
like a human computer. I mean, there's nothing he doesn't know about or for me, he's like a superhero. He's like Doc Savage. I mean, he can do anything. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, this guy, his knowledge base is just amazing. And I call him up, and I'd ask him these questions about, because he's very, I mean, when he writes something, he wants it to be exactly that.
Sure.
And I call him up, and I said, well, you want a Plymouth, you know, what kind of Plymouth is it? And we got to talking, and little by little, you know, we became close. I mean, really, really close. Now, this is a term I use, brother. You know, I mean, there's genetic brothers, and there's, you know, although we're not related, you know, blood-wise, I mean, he's part of my family, and, you know, he's done a lot of things for me, and I've become very involved with his work, because I think it's really important.
It is.
But I'm really proud to be able to say that. I'm going to bring it up because I'm very proud of my association with him, because he's one of the few people that I've ever met that has done a lot of good for the world. And, corny as that might sound, but it's true.
No, it is true. And,
he still does it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, no, they a wonderful work. Also wonderful work on Cross as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, that was, you know, that was something that he'd want me to, when they would, he always wants me to draw it. And I said, I'm too slow. And we always talk about doing something, but, and maybe we will, but I hope so. But, you know, he wanted me to draw the characters and the covers, and I don't think I did a very good job. But I've never really been happy with anything I've done for him, because he's so intimidating that I get intimidated by it. It just seems like I can't.
Well, I enjoy the collaborations. I think
they're
great.
I appreciate it. You know, he just amazes me. You know, I mean, he was. They did a Batman, you know, and I was supposed to draw that. And
the Ultimate Evil, yes.
Yeah. And something came up because, you know, they, of course, wanted it really, really fast. And, you know, I said, well, it'd take me this long to do it. I never heard back from him, and they just turned it over to somebody else.
Because I've read the novel.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And yeah, I didn't read the graphic novel. If it, you know,
I it's like when I was reading, I read the novel. I was amazed. I said, "Well, how much? I mean, do you know about?" Because he seemed to know the Batman thing pretty well, and I was surprised because I'm always surprised he knows so much stuff. I go, because he deals with things that are so serious and
sure.
Horrible and real. I mean, not like the Joker and all that crap, but I mean, like real monsters.
Yes.
And, you know, whatever Batman has to deal with is almost insignificant in a way, because it's all, you know, I'm going to, you know, get all this money from Gotham City Bank or whatever the hell it is. But him, I mean, it's just, and, you know, he managed to work it in there, and it's just, wow, and he knew all the, I mean, it's just amazing. You know, about the Batcave and the Batmobile, and it's funny to me.
And he clearly was a fan. I mean,
he's not at all.
So
that's an amazing thing.
So he just did research for it.
Well, not that much. He just talked to somebody. He just sort of put two and two together and say, well, this guy does this and does this because of this. And I know he got a lot of flack because I think, as I remember in the novel, I think his mother was working with abused kids and this and that, and you messed with the Batman mythos. And, you know, I think Denny O'Neill was up in arms. And,
oh, that's too bad.
And he said, "Well, the only way that this thing can be printed is if you say it's a Batman Elseworlds novel." Like, what about that horse shit? Anyway, can you say horse shit on the radio?
Yeah, well, this is the internet, Jeff. You can say anything you want, man. That's okay.
Cool.
So right now you're working on Shaolin Cowboy,
yeah.
And are there any other projects you've got, or is Shaolin quite the handful?
Well, it is a handful, but yeah, I do other things. I mean, little illustrations here and there, and I just moved, so I haven't worked in a long time because all my stuff is somewhere in America. I think it's on a train headed here, and I don't know. You know, I saw of it was in Paris, France, on the 30th of June, and we're almost at the end of August, and it still isn't here yet. It got held up in customs, and from what I understand, they found they thought they saw something suspicious because they Xeroxed the container, and they were going to take it off and go through everything. And I guess they did. because I knew it cost me a lot of money. Because I had to actually pay for it. I had to pay for them.
That's pretty lousy.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
if,
at the
as
same
long
time,
I'm
happy that they are actually, you know, because who knows, you know.
Sure.
But the problem with being, you know, a comic book and an artist and a collector is that I got a lot of stuff that probably would look kind of funny if you x-rayed it, you know.
Yeah, a lot of suspicious drawings.
Well, yeah, or you know, anything can look like a bomb these days.
That's true.
You know, if you have a, you know, like a vacuum cleaner in there, they don't know.
Now, how is it as an expatriate coming back, and not at, you know, not that you left under many, you know, Roman Polanski circumstances, but
no,
you know, but I'm saying as someone that did come back after spending a long time in Europe, what's it like being back in America now?
It's, you know, everybody in France is just like, geez, you're such a great thing. You're get out of here, because I mean the mood in France is so bad. It's just everyone is so depressed because. There's just this sense of things are just going to get worse and worse. And despite the fact that, politically speaking, the climate here is, you know, it's gotten really weird.
Yeah.
It's still a place where you can get things done and things can change. France has a hard time with change. They want to change, but they don't want to give anything up. And sometimes you just have to give up some things to make things better, but they just don't want to sacrifice it. Living in Paris is getting really, really hard because just people are so fed up that the least little thing. I never saw so many fist fights. Just people, motorists getting in fights with each other. I just thank God they don't have guns over there.
Wow.
Because it would, you know, they'd be going at it. It would be like a Western over there.
Well, I, you know, welcome back, and here's hoping that things get a little bit better, and you know, as far as what's going on here in the country.
Yeah, I mean, things can. I mean, yeah, well, I'm always optimistic, although I don't know why. I still can't fathom that last. I mean, in the very beginning, I can't understand why they didn't want his dad. You know. Why they wanted his son, you know. For whatever he is, his dad at least sort of did something, you know. He was a pilot, and, you know, and the son just seems like somebody that just kind of doop-de-doop-doop-doo.
Yeah.
And if they rejected the father, why do they think the son would be any better?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think the producers of South Park got it right when they said you're choosing between the giant douche and the shit sandwich. And take your pick in terms of who won, unfortunately. I mean, I think
I'd rather have a douche.
I voted for the douche, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, a douche in French means a bath. So I'd take a bath over a shit sandwich any day.
I'm with you. Well, Jeff, I've taken you over an hour, and I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I will say I really appreciate the talk tonight.
I appreciate your interest, and anything to promote Burley Man, because it's a rough market out there, and you know. We've done isn't exactly, you know, it's a typical comic book fair, so. Although it is, but.
They're two distinct properties, and yeah, people check them out. Doc Frankenstein, co-created by Jeff, and his personal baby that's running Shaolin Cowboy, issue 4 coming out in the middle of September.
Action-packed.
And
28 pages of solid action.
And a talking ass. What more can you want?
Yeah, I think that's me. as anybody who's been listening to this would now know.
No, we appreciate it, Jeff. Thank you.
Okay.
Jeff Darrow in a conversation from August of 2004. As I said at the start of the show, Jeff is currently working on the Speed Racer movie with the Wachowskis in Los Angeles. It may not be around much during the convention season, but you can be sure once Speed Racer is about to be unveiled, Jeff will be on the scene, just as he was for The Matrix. And hopefully that means it'll be a return to his comic books. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you liked them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% and more. That's right, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. For all the details, go to MailOrderComics.com. That wraps up this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks for listening. This is John Suntris. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet. MySpace.com/WordBalloon. ComicSpace.com/WordBalloon. iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, and of course our home at Newsarama.com. If you have any questions, I'm always available by email, john@wordballoon.com, and lots of new episodes are on the way. We had a few technical snafus and just needed a quick break over the week. Thanks for being patient. Don't worry, great new material coming up. All the creators you want to hear on wordballoon.com. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007.